Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and this episode is Q&A number 25. As usual, if you have questions that you want me to answer on the podcast, send them to michael@scientifictriathlon.com or through the Facebook Messenger widget on scientifictriathlon.com. Big thanks to today's sponsor, Roka. Roka are the world leaders in wetsuits, trisuits, and other triathlon and swim apparel, but also they are world leaders in performance eyewear for triathletes, endurance athletes, cyclists. They create sunglasses that, unlike others, never fall off your face, even if you try as hard as you can to shake them off due to their incredible GeekoFit technology. The optical quality has trademarked C3 advanced optics, and they are extremely, extremely comfortable, so light that you keep forgetting that you're wearing them. In the US, Roka also has home try-on options available for the performance eyewear, and they now have prescription glasses as well, with all the same features and benefits as the sunglasses that they have. No pressure points, lightweight, won't fall off your face, etc. You can get 20% off. Whether you're interested in the performance eyewear or the traditional triathlon apparel line of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, etc., go to roka.com and browse their stores. There is a US store, but now, as you know, Roka also ships directly from the UK and the EU, so that makes life so much easier for us here on this side of the pond. And you can take 20% off your entire order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Before today's questions, I have a very important announcement, and that is that I'm looking to bring on somebody for a part-time customer support role to the Scientific Triathlon team here, because I'm really working myself into the ground sometimes here with with all the support requests that come in and the questions, etc. So I need somebody that can help with that, and that person should be, of course, enjoying triathlon and enjoying talking with triathletes. They should have be fairly knowledgeable in triathlon, because I want this person to be able to answer specific questions about training plans and that sort of thing. They should also be highly motivated and service minded. They should be very good at communicating both verbally and in writing, and they should be able to figure things out and solve things without too much handholding, and have a can-do attitude, because there may be things that that are not purely support related things here as well that that we can figure out for you to do, depending on what your skill set is. So, but in that case, that sort of can-do attitude and making figure outable things happen, I guess, that's something that I'm definitely considering an important attribute. So if you are interested in this role, or you know somebody who is interested in this role, send me an email to michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and that's Michael with a K, and we can take it from there. Even if you're not sure if it's for you, please contact me, and we can figure it out if it's right for you or not. I should mention that you can do it from anywhere in the world. It's a remote role, and probably at the start it will consist of, I guess, 1 to 2 hours per weekday. But those hours are flexible. You don't have to do them at a specific time. It can be whenever, really. So it's fairly flexible. Regarding the questions, the Q&As, before the questions for today, just a quick note that the backlog of questions keeps piling up. So again, I want to try to take a few more questions. And this week, I think I'll answer 3 different questions. Or I know I will do that, actually, because I have planned this episode. I'm not doing it off the cuff. So again, maybe slightly less detailed than in some previous Q&As where I have only answered 1 or 2. I do appreciate any feedback that you have on whether you prefer 1 or 2 very in-depth questions per Q&A episodes, or do you want more questions covered, like 3 or 4 questions per episode, which of course would mean better chances of getting your questions answered as well. So please let me know, email me, message me. I'd love to hear your feedback. This first question is from Sondre in Norway, and he asks, what is your take on feel prescribed session versus power or pace prescribed. My coach has me doing all intervals on feel or RPE, rating of perceived exertion. His argument is that it's not the actual power or pace output that matters, but the effort. Not being held back by a prescribed power range on days when the athlete is feeling great and pushed too hard on weaker days when you can't hold the power range. So that's the coach's idea. I still record power and pace, but it's not. I don't look at it during the session, but after. The managing of future training is then based on if a high power or pace was produced in the session with a relatively lower RPE or vice versa. And the alternative would be that that the coach prescribes a power or pace range and the athlete would aim to hit those ranges and then report back RPE instead. And Sondre writes, personally, I think that an objective power range with some subjective description of the session would be the best. For example, 3 times 15 minutes at 90 to 95% of FTP, where the first interval should feel quite sustainable. By the end of rep 3, you should be pretty tired, but not bonking. I think it is the coach's job to guide the athlete on what intensities to execute, and the athlete should still have awareness. If the athlete on a particular day feels it's too hard to hold 90%, for example, in that above session, 3 times 15 minutes, then the athlete should make a decision and adjust the session, for example, back to 85%, or do just 3 times 10 minutes, or even just break it off and spin for the rest of the session instead. All right, so this is a really, really great question. And first of all, I will say that there are many ways to skin a cat. For example, somebody like Daniela Rief trains pretty much exclusively on RPE, so feel-based prescription, to the best of my knowledge. And I've heard Brett Sutton talk live and discussed Daniela Rief's training in a lot of detail. So I actually know that this is probably the way that they do it, unless he was lying. But I don't think so. And we also heard on, for example, as late as in Monday's interview with Joel Filial in episode 172, that his squad, which consists of the best of the best in the short course triathlon world, they rely pretty heavily on RPE as well, except for in running where they have speed limits. So it's clear that a feel-based prescription or RPE-based prescription can work really, really, really well because some of the best in the world are doing it. On the other hand, I do think that, we know that when we're talking quality workouts, like those interval workouts, the actual output, it really does matter. It's not about how hard your body perceives it as much as about how hard you're actually going. So if you're doing VO2 max intervals, for example, and you can't hit a power that is close enough to your power associated with VO2 max, which is called PVO2 max, then you're not going to get the intended stimulus regardless of how hard it feels. And in this case, if it's not possible to produce that output that you're after within a certain range, then in that case, yes, so shortening the intervals might be one option to do as first, and if you then can hit the intensity range that is targeted, then fine. But if you still can't do that, then backing off the intensity completely might be the best option, because otherwise you just keep pushing and you keep pushing and you perceive it as being very hard, but you don't get the stimulus that you or your coach intended you to get through that workout, because you're just not getting that power up there to that level. And VO2 max intervals, they are like, in this case, it's very clear that this is the case. I guess the lower down you go on the power spectrum, it becomes less and less clear like where the boundary is, I guess. So there is a spectrum here for sure. And I think that this mostly goes for the higher intensity workouts. So I still think that things like threshold workouts, you'll still want to, the range is broader for sure than VO2 max intervals, but there is still a limit where you're not really hitting the intended range at all, and then you should back it off and not do the intensity because you're not getting that benefit. So, but on that easy end of the spectrum, on the other hand, with easy workout, there really isn't such a thing as going too easy. You'll hear on Monday, actually, in my interview with Dr. Philip Skiba, who is one of the most sought-after experts in the endurance sports world, although he's a bit somebody that not a lot of people know about because he's not very much out there on the social media and that sort of thing. But he worked with the Breaking 2 project, so he was a consultant for Nike. And I distinctly remember he talked about how Eliud Kipchoge and these other guys that are running marathons at 2 hours or very close to 2 hours, that they start their easy runs at an eight, sometimes their long runs, I should say, at an 8 to 8:30 minutes per mile pace, which would mean 5 minutes to 5:45 minutes per kilometers or so. So 5 minutes, 45 seconds per kilometer pace. So a crazy easy pace. Like there are a lot of age groupers that can't run a 3 hour marathon, that run all their runs at a faster pace than that, which is definitely wrong. It's not something that you should do, but it goes to show. And Joel also mentioned this in Monday's interview, which I think was absolutely fantastic. One of the best that we've had on this podcast, that that there really isn't such a thing as going too easy. So I think on easy workouts, you can definitely go by RPE alone, as long as you're somebody who don't overshoot the intensity range. On the other hand, some athletes, they will feel that it's easy, but they're actually going in the moderate intensity power zone or pace zone. So then you need to tell them to actually follow power or pace to back off that, to have both RPE be easy, but also to have the quantifiable, more quantifiable metrics, and objective metrics is the right word, be in the easy zone as well. So that's a long-winded way of saying that actually I do 100% agree with your personal opinion that for most age group athletes, at least, I think that having that objective target range, so a power or pace range that you're trying to hit, but also combining that with a subjective description, as you say, is the way to go. There's a great observation there that you make about how the coach needs to guide the athlete to execute the workout, because we're not robots, so we can't execute the workouts as a robot. So we should execute it as human beings, which means that our bodies and our physiologies are in a constant state of change and flux. So trying to hit an exact target wattage or pace every time for a given workout is meaningless, absolutely meaningless. And equally meaningless is trying to or expecting to set a new personal best at any given workout every time either. That's just not the way it works, and that's not how you're going to improve the most. So each workout should be seen as part of the process of training and executing on that process rather than isolating the workout. And for this reason, yes, you should have a power range, but also, as you say, you should have that subjective description of what the workout should feel like, so that if you are fine dropping 10 watts compared to your last week's workout, if that means that you still stay in the same, in the intended intensity range, but also the perceived effort is what it should be and not much, much higher than it actually should be for that particular workout. So related to this, on this topic, I'm actually not a big fan of using erg mode in workouts unless the athlete is very experienced and in tune with their body. And if they are, then I know that the athlete will adjust the intensity according to what they've got on the day. But for less experienced athletes, I think that erg mode, it might either be holding them back on their good days or pushing them too hard on their weaker days, all depending on what the state of the athlete is on that particular day. So I personally use erg mode, but I do liberally adjust the intensity. I just use it, I guess, as a simplification thing. It gives me less things to think about. But when I feel that things are too easy or too hard, I adjust the intensity immediately. So one thing that I want to add still is that I think that for any athlete, but especially for less experienced athletes or athletes that tend to get too hung up on numbers. And risk factors for this type of athlete, by the way, I have done a lot of observations here. I've been doing my field work and I have observed that typically males between 30 and 50 years of age, especially those in engineering or other very quantitative lines of work, they have a risk factor of getting too hung up on numbers. I think that for them, it's great to actually do a period, let's say go a month where you train just purely to RPE And you do not look, just as you're doing right now with your coach, just looking at, not looking at your watch, but only recording and looking at the data afterwards, and following RPE completely for a month, because that's really a fantastic learning experience, and that will help these athletes then transition into using both the subjective perceived exertion and the objective numbers, pace and power numbers. So the body awareness and intuition of how to execute workouts is going to get so much better if you take a period where you just train to RPE. And again, as I said, this is especially for the less experienced athletes and the athletes that are, I think that, you know, if you are an athlete that gets too hung up on numbers, and I'm not speaking to you, Sondre, I'm speaking to the listeners here, because I know that you are a very experienced athlete, so you likely don't have the problem, and you're already training to RPE anyway. So this is more so for the benefit of the listeners. But to sum up, I think that you should be using both, and as you say, like having a target range, not a target number, but a target range, but also knowing what that sort of intended intensity should feel like on the day. So you can adjust within the range, but also slightly outside the range if really needed. And if then the adjustments become too big, then you need to do some big adjustment, like not doing intensity on that day. So that's the first question. Thank you for that question, Sondre. It was a good one. The next one is from Russell in London, who writes, hey, what's up? I'm very new to triathlon, but did a sprint last summer and decided to keep the momentum up by entering an Ironman in 2019. Last November, I came back from holiday with an IT band issue, and I haven't been able to run since, although I had no issues running prior to this. I'm seeing a physiotherapist, but would like to know what alternative cardio you would recommend whilst I can't run, and will this prepare me for an Ironman in time? My aim is complete and not to compete. Thanks. Hi, Russell. So thank you for your question. It's a good one. I'm sorry to hear about your injury, and I hope things are working out. It's really great that you're seeing a physiotherapist, because that's absolutely the very first thing that you should do whenever you have an injury. The answer to your question as for what alternative cardio I would recommend while not running is, I have a somewhat vague answer, I guess, and it's whatever you can do and will do. So in other words, let's say that theoretically aqua running might be one of the best, most specific methods of cross training for running. If you really don't enjoy aqua running, then you just won't do it enough, and then whatever you enjoy more will actually do you much more good. So don't disregard the cross-training effect of cycling and swimming that you can do, actually. That might be a much better form of cross-training if you don't enjoy that aqua running or whatever you decide to try. But if we talk about, if let's say that you enjoy everything and that's not a concern, then I do think aqua running, it's good. It's very specific for running. I also think cross-country skiing, and I wrote this to you earlier because your question came in a couple of months ago, but I just haven't been able to get to it until now on the podcast. So now it's getting into that time of year where cross-country skiing isn't really that much on the agenda anymore. But that or the ski ergometer, they are two quite effective forms as well. I should say that ski ergometer, I'm not so sure. I've actually never used a ski ergometer. And I think that depends on what kind of ski ergometer it is. If it's classic style where you're actually using your legs, or if it's just using your arms. So just the poles, I guess, or that's what it simulates. So I'll keep my mouth shut on that because I just don't know. But cross-country skiing, actually out in the wild, that's very effective. Of course, in London, I should have thought of that, but that's not really an option for you. But I do coach quite a few athletes in the Scandinavian countries, so that's why cross-country skiing comes to mind as an excellent form of cross-training. The elliptical or cross trainer is another great option, probably up there with aqua running. And I know that Meb Kefletsigi, I'm always messing it up, and I'm so sorry because I should really know how to say Meb's name. But he uses the Elliptigo scooter, which is like a vehicle, like a moving elliptical, I guess. And they do that with his coach, Bob Larson, I think his name is. And And they use that all the time, not just for not for injury rehabilitation, but for actually injury prevention. They replace some of his running with that elliptigo and elliptical training. Of course, maybe it's probably sponsored by them, but I'm sure that he wouldn't use it if he didn't rate it and actually perceive that it is something that benefits his training, because elite athletes just don't work that way. They will do what it takes to become the best of the best, not just use tools for the sake of using them. So the elliptical or cross trainer is a good option as well, although it's quite boring, in my opinion. That's my personal opinion. Anyway, I hope that this helps, but whatever you can do and will do is probably the big takeaway for this question. So the final question for today is from Martin. Martin, I don't remember if you sent me your location, but I don't have it here in my notes. Anyway, Martin's question is, I wish I'd sent this question in sooner. I think it would have been relevant around the Q&A episodes 15 and 16, where you talked about having a big day in the lead up to an Ironman. Hopefully it's still relevant. And I was wondering how you schedule these big days into your training plan. I don't think I would need any tapering in the lead up, but I definitely think I would need extra recovery, or is that wrong? My A race is at the beginning of June, so would it be right to schedule the big day 8 weeks beforehand at the beginning of April? All right, so first, just a quick note for those that don't know the concept of a big day. That's a day where you aim to spend a large chunk of hours swimming, biking, and running to sort of simulate that fatigue resistance and train that fatigue resistance that you'll need in an Ironman. You don't need to do these as a brick workout. You can swim first thing in the morning, go home, have breakfast, get out on the bike and ride for a long time, get home and eat something, put your feet up for a while, and then go out for a long run in the evening. So it does not have to be a brick, but it should all be in one day. And typically it might be a 1 hour swim, a 5 hour bike. And the run is really where it depends. It can be anything from 1 hour to 2 hours usually, but usually not more than 2 hours. But it can be 2 hours. So that's the concept of a big day. If you do one big day in your lead up to an Ironman, I would recommend doing it 4 or 5 weeks before the race. And that's how I have it in my programs. For example, the intermediate Ironman program that recently launched, it's 4 weeks before the race in that program. If you do two, actually I have two in that program because it's a long program. It's 20 weeks. So you will have scope to do two big days in the lead up because you will already be very fit by the time you do the first. And that's the important thing here, that you need to be fit enough when you do your first big day. So that's why 8 weeks out, it can be done, but it depends. You need to have built up to that level of fitness to be able to actually do it and not put yourself in a hole at that point. But if you have two, then my recommendation would be, again, do the last one 4 weeks before the race. And then the first one you would do 4 weeks before the previous one, or 4 weeks before the last one. So that would be 8 weeks out. So that would be in the example where you do two big days. And so in the example of my intermediate Ironman plan, it's a 20-week plan. So you've already done 12 weeks of great training when you go into that first big day. And then you get another four-week block before the second one, and then 4 weeks until the race. So again, 8 weeks, doing it, as you suggest, 8 weeks before your race for doing one big day, that's not wrong, but you need to make sure that you have enough of a fitness base and have trained for long enough if you are to do that. And I would probably recommend doing it a bit later, doing it 4 to 5 weeks or maybe 6 weeks before the race. You're right that you do not need to taper in the lead up. I do like to make the day before very easy, something like a light bike or a light swim, because we need easy days anyway. So I try to schedule a light day before that big day. But much more important than that is, as you say, the recovery after the big day. The big day should definitely be followed by a few days of low volume training, no intensity. So as an example, rest the day after the big day, or you could do some active recovery that might be just as good or even better. And then do 3 days of light training. So just recovery, zone one, maybe zone two intensities, nothing hard. And also not too much volume. Don't try to replace the lack of intensity with volume, because you really want to, you've put your body under a massive overload there. And what you want to happen is to have a super compensation, but that can only happen if your body gets rested enough and gets recovered enough that it can adapt to that stimulus. So you need to give your body the space and time to do so. So Martin has a second part of the question, which is more generally, I always wonder about this with B races. If, for example, I was able to do a half Ironman in the run-up to my Ironman, would I race it at Ironman pace or half Ironman pace? Conventional wisdom would say that you have a small taper for a B race, so does that mean a bit more recovery would be in order following the B race? Many thanks and keep up the great podcasting, Martin. All right, thanks again for this question, Martin. It's a really good one. So for if you have a half-distance race in the lead-up and it's a B race, it's not your A race, but most athletes still want to have a decent race because you spent a lot of time training already and you spent some money to enter that race and a lot of time, and you will be out there for a long time. So you want to have a decent race, most likely. So I would say that a few days of tapering is an appropriate compromise, and then for a B race, and then having a fairly similar recovery structure to what I just mentioned for the big day. Maybe for a half distance race, because it's actually, for most of us at least, much shorter than a big day, you can increase the easy volume a bit quicker in that recovery period compared to for a big day. But still, keep those 4 days or so with no intensity after that race. That's my advice. It could be five, it could be six even. I don't think that you're in a rush to get back to intensity. But I think that definitely three is the absolute minimum. But yeah, I probably wouldn't risk it. I think it's getting a bit risky there. So I would definitely use 4 days with no intensity as a good rule of thumb. And this means if you have 4 days of recovery and you have, let's say, 3 days of tapering or that before the race, this means that in total you're quote unquote sacrificing about a week of normal training. But in most of our training programs, you are going to want to have some easier periods, maybe not an entire week, but easier periods anyway. So it might be 5 days of easier training, and now you're having seven. You're having that race in between. So you're not really sacrificing much. You just, as long as you plan that race in such that you can have good training leading into it, so you don't have a recovery week the week before that race, you just use that small taper period and that small recovery period as the recovery week, so to say, and doing the race in the middle of it. So that's how I would go about it. So that recovery week would run from, for example, Thursday through Wednesday rather than Monday through Sunday. And as for the pacing question, I would definitely say that if you sign up for a half distance race, go for your best effort at that distance. I can only think of one exception to that rule that I've seen, and that was when I had an athlete that was doing a 70.3 race just 1 week before her Ironman A race, where she wanted to qualify for Kona. So, whoops, scheduling mistake. But she had already started tapering for that Ironman the week. Well, obviously, we had planned this. So her taper started roughly 2 weeks before the Ironman, maybe 10 or 12 days or something. So what we decided to do in that 70.3 was to race the swim at her best effort, race the bike at her best effort, but then just jog in the run. So because that's the most difficult to recover from with the eccentric loading of the run and the neuromuscular strain. So she jogged that in, and she actually still managed to podium in an Ironman 70.3 in the 35 to 39 female age group, so very competitive, and then raced the Ironman next week and qualified for Kona. So that was an exception to the rule. But in general, I would say that even if you're racing 2 weeks out, then give it your best effort, and then your taper starts, and you're recovering. The recovery from that hard half Ironman is part of your tapering. So that's how I would go about it. Thanks again, Martin, for your question. So that wraps it up for today. Keep sending in questions. They're really great, and I really appreciate all the interaction and the feedback. If you haven't already, you absolutely have to go back and listen to Monday's episode 172 with Joel Filial. It's already a modern classic, I want to say, on this podcast. And just before we go, a quick reminder again that I am looking for that part-time customer support person. You don't have to have any experience in that sort of role at all, but you need to be a self-starter, motivated, knowledgeable about triathlon, and service-minded. And remember, it's a remote job. You can do it from anywhere in the world, and the hours are flexible and part-time, starting out fairly small, but hopefully they will be growing with time. So if you are this person or you know somebody who is this person, email me at michael@scientifictriathlon.com. That's Michael with a K, and we'll take it from there. All right, big thanks to Roka for sponsoring this podcast. If you're looking for wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, buoyancy shorts, anything in those categories, look no further than roka.com and use the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, for 20% off your entire order. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.